Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those above them. Today, Disrespect interviews Richard DeGelder of ThinkHouse, a hackerspace, one of four and the largest and only industrial hackerspace in Ontario. What is a hackerspace? Well, if you have less than a full schedule through the Christmas holidays, or maybe you don't like those empty days afterwards, the hackerspace gives you something to play with. Disrespect welcomes Richard DeGelder of ThinkHouse, Canada's biggest hackerspace, a new space in Hamilton, on June the 1st. Richard, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, you've been telling me a little bit about what this is about, and your overarching point is that this is not a place for illegal activity. So what is it a place for?
It's a place for collaborating with people, innovating, modifying things to perform functions that maybe the original manufacturer didn't intend, but are available that you want them to do.
Okay.
We hack software to some degree, but we also have a fair amount of industrial space that allows us to build, to modify, to realign and set things up. Among the things we do is anything from making kites, several of our members are involved in. There's sewing crafts involved. There is welding. There is some minor engineering. We end up covering quite a few different areas. But yes, it's in some ways it's a common workshop with tools that either the space has provided or members have loaned to the space for you to build, to modify, to create different things with.
That's quite a broad mandate. It sounds intimidating.
It's not, because although there's a tremendous number of skills and there's some very skilled people in the facility, there's or within the group, there's also the willingness to participate and to share knowledge. Most projects end up having one person who, to some degree, leads the project, but there are other people who contribute to some less, some more, to enhance the project in the areas that they know what they're doing.
Yeah.
So if you're not familiar with a particular thing, there probably is somebody who can help you along, or at least provide some ideas.
Okay. And you were one of 15 founders. I guess the 15 founders probably encompass much of the activity that's begun there.
Yeah, for the first 6 months, we did an awful lot of building within the space. We rented a 2,300 square foot warehouse space, and so there had to be some construction within the space. But there's also been projects going on for a wide variety of different things that cover a whole range of different skills that, yeah, we're starting to have fun. We're starting to create projects at this point in time.
So these sound like collective projects.
Most of them are.
Oh, okay.
There are some projects which are almost exclusively one person's things.
So you don't have to have your own project to take part in this?
No.
Okay.
there, some people have joined specifically for access to the space.
Yeah.
There is one gentleman who has a forge and is making things, tools, in a small forge.
In this place?
In this space.
All right.
There's others who have used some of the woodworking equipment, welding equipment, and so forth to produce projects. Most of them end up being collaborative to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you don't. By the same token, if you have a project that you, a small project you want to do on your own, it doesn't have to be collaborative either.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you put a little bit of money into this space to get it going. Where did the money come from? I understand none of it was government money.
No. Most of it's all from the individual people who, who with their monthly dues. We have one gentleman who is guaranteed for at least a while to make up any shortfalls that we encounter.
Oh.
So we have, an angel investor to some degree. But there, most of the money has all come from individual dues and so forth.
All right. And so you've called this Think House.
Yes. We were looking for a name, and that was the name we came up with. There are actually right now four hackerspaces in Ontario. There's one in Toronto. There's and they have a small space above a store. There's one in Kitchener, another one in Guelph. Both of them have office-type spaces. We're the only industrial space in Ontario.
Okay.
We have the largest area. We have the biggest capacity to for with tools and so forth. And yes, we recently acquired a laser, so we now have the most powerful laser of any hackerspace in North America.
And this is for cutting?
For cutting, etching. Right now we are, several of our members right now are modifying the laser to better suit what we need, which is a perfect example of what, of hacking.
Yeah.
We took a product, found it not quite satisfactory to what we wanted to do with it, or, and so several people are contributing towards enhancing it to at least fulfill the needs that we have. And eventually we'll build our own laser.
Oh.
We'll end up acquiring a number of parts, but at least mechanical and electronics parts of it we'll be able to do ourselves.
Interesting.
And there will be other projects. We are about to receive a 3D printer so we can start doing rapid prototyping. Think of it as a normal printer, but instead of ink, we can do layers of plastic so we can print plastic parts. Things like, so that leads us to a whole new range of options and things that we can do.
Right.
Within the space. And each of those pieces of equipment is generally available to all the members.
Uh-huh.
Some require that you at least know how to use it properly.
Right.
But as a member of the space, you have 24 hours access to the space, 7 days a week.
Wow.
And access to the equipment to use as you want.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's an interesting place to be.
I mean, it's right now it's a small enough group that everybody knows whether you're a member. Are you going to put some kind of security in so that only members have access?
We already have that installed. We have a pass key for that allows us to get into the space and a security code for the members to access it.
Mm-hmm.
Our initial thing for the pass key was actually came out of the Toronto hackerspace.
Oh, yeah.
It was a software and hardware project that came from them that we used. And so we're also looking at integrating the things better. We have so we have complete security in the space, so the equipment is at least protected.
Yeah.
We have video cameras as well, so we know who is and who coming in and out of the space.
Right.
But, yes, it
and they do monitoring in real time as well as to tape.
Yes.
Okay.
And so there are things that are designed to be able to protect the space. Some of the tools in the future may require having a locked access as well, so limiting things. But at present, outside of the perimeter security, anybody once you're in, yes, you have access to all the equipment.
Right.
We have an open house every Tuesday, which we invite the general public to come.
Oh, really? And what time is that?
From 7 o'clock every Tuesday evening.
Okay. And where?
It's 152 Niagara, right at the corner of Niagara and Land. It's in the north end, just north, approximately Burlington Street and Wentworth Streets, about a block in each direction from that.
Okay.
So it is in the north end. It is in very much industrial space.
Yeah.
There are residents right around the area, but yes.
Okay.
It allows us to make noise at night as well, which we don't have to worry about disturbing the residents.
I think that's important when you're doing the kind of things you're doing. Yeah.
When you're using a forge and you know and pounding on metal, it really becomes a nice thing to know that you're not disturbing the person next door.
Is there an opportunity? Then I realize this isn't the focus of the space, but is there an opportunity to train or pass on heritage skills like working in a forge? Could somebody from outside come in with other skills and end up learning how to use a forge?
There's a very much willingness for people to train other people in their skills. So the gentleman who's brought in the forge is more than willing to show you how to use that forge, and as long as you are willing to pay for the fuel that gets used,
which is what propane.
Propane for this one. We're looking at natural gas too, but as long as you're willing to pay for the fuel that's used, and so with anything with the consumables that end up being used, there's a willingness for you to be allowed to use the equipment as well.
Okay.
The equipment within the space isn't designed to be only for one person.
Right.
It may be initially. It may be that you know, but once you learn the skills to use that equipment properly.
Yeah.
In a safe manner and so without damaging the equipment.
Yeah.
It becomes available for those people to use it as well for their own projects and things like that.
Okay.
Or to collaborate with others to create a project.
Now you spoke of in great brevity you spoke about some of the projects that are taking place in ThinkHouse. Can you tell us a little bit more about what's planned in the near future, these collaborative projects, individual projects, without endangering the project?
There's some work right now being done on building an unmanned aerial vehicle.
Aerial vehicle?
Yes.
Okay.
Several of the members are collaborating with Design Electronics in order to build a very small drone, with the idea that as they perfect certain functions, they can add more functions to it with later revisions.
Mm-hmm.
There's a gentleman working on an underwater vehicle to be able to photograph underwater as a submersible camera system.
I think the oil industry would be after him.
It's not going to be able to go to great depths, but at least it'll be able to look for things underwater.
All right.
Things along that line.
All right.
For an unmanned aerial vehicle, there's somebody who wants to be able to mount a telescope into an unmanned plane and be able to do astrological photography. So there are a whole pile of different projects that get along. One of the projects that we will be doing shortly is building our own rapid prototyping 3D printer, and we'll probably end up building a mill, a CNC mill as well, in the near future. And that comes, too, from learning the different techniques with one thing, with a few people, and it going on being used for other functions as well.
I'm not sure everybody knows what a CNC mill is, although probably the people who are most interested do.
It's computer numeric control. So rather than an individual coming along and setting the controls, the computer tells the mill where to go, how to perform the functions.
So in effect, you can feed it a drawing.
Yes.
Come out with a product in 3D.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
And although the mill ends up being a subtractive thing, you start off with a piece of metal and you take away metal, or you take away from whatever the material is.
Gotcha.
The 3D printer works exactly the opposite way.
Oh.
You start off with nothing and you now put plastic where you want it to be.
Oh, okay.
Rather than removing it.
Okay.
So, and it's a type of product photography, or it's a product development that exists for rapid prototyping or for very, very small runs.
Right.
But we're being able to develop it also for ourselves.
Right.
A lot of the things that we're looking at, other people have developed things, and they tend to be collaborative even outside of our group.
Mm-hmm.
The 3D printer or the rapid prototyper that we're looking at producing in the next few months has an international group of people that started in England, mm-hmm. but has an international following that are developing this product. So,
the rapid prototyping product?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. It's called a RepRap, RAP.
All right.
And
so your work is amplified by people on an international scale.
Yes. Very much in the same way that open source for software does it. We tend to do things more in the hardware aspect with this space.
Open source hardware, yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
And the benefit of something like that is that you end up with an awful lot of highly skilled people who contribute towards the development and the product.
Right.
So it's not just a closed source where you can only talk to a handful of people. This is anybody who's interested can participate in the discussion.
Yeah.
And can influence the direction it goes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah.
If you're willing to be more than a sharp tongue, you could probably play a key role.
Yes. And the people who tend to make the largest contributions are the people who are willing to get their hands dirty or so. But, you know, and to prove their skills and so forth. But it still ends up being people who can contribute to the whole thing.
Yeah.
And because it ends up being in an open source type of environment, you are standing on the shoulder of giants. You are being able to take the combined collaborative effort and use it for yourself without having to pay phenomenal amounts of money.
Yeah.
And without being restricted in how you can use it.
Yeah. Yeah, the open source concept is very appealing in that venue.
We've proven it with software. You look at something like the Linux operating system, you look at OpenOffice,
yeah.
and you look at all the phenomenal amounts of software that's available.
Yeah.
And you look at it from the point that the hardware is starting to get in the same direction.
Yeah. Yeah. Does it have the same, I guess there's a smattering of the same social goals along with it too. That the world needn't be full of immense amounts of capital to accomplish immense things. There simply needs to be collaboration.
One of the things with the rapid prototyping is if you have a small appliance that a small part broke, it's almost impossible to get a replacement part,
right?
Which usually means that product is now redundant. It now ends up not being able to be used anymore.
Mm-hmm.
If you could come in, scan the broken part, in software mend that break,
mm-hmm.
and print a new part,
mm-hmm.
you now have the ability to keep something going.
Isn't that interesting?
It means you don't have to buy a new one. It means the product doesn't go into a landfill or recycling or anything like that. And if you're looking at it for a green type of thing, the first thing is reduce. Well, if I don't need to buy as many products because of minor breaks,
mm-hmm.
I've reduced my overall consumptions
mm-hmm.
tremendously.
Mm-hmm.
And if I come along and use the rapid prototyping to enhance a product in a way that the manufacturer hadn't thought was economical or viable, then I get more value out of that same product without having to depend on somebody else to produce it.
So is it safe then to say that you reap the benefits of a craft ethic, repair, reuse, adapt, without the high cost of proprietary labor input, without the high cost?
Certainly, certainly. If you look at if you look at the earliest 20th century with the arts and crafts movement, it went for furniture, it went for house design and things along that line, with very much the idea that the average person can build most of the things around them in a sturdy manner and so forth. We've taken the same general idea and applied it in a much wider thing. Not only can we build our own things for, you know, that are useless little trinkets in some case, we can also build very useful products with it. And with the skills within the group and the ability to access information with the internet, which is so easy nowadays, you can do a tremendous number of things. And to enhance your own lifestyle and to reduce your carbon footprint and things along that line. Because I don't need to have a product come from China or a small part come from China to repair a piece that's right here in front of me. I can, in some cases, enhance or replace parts right here. Therefore, also reducing our carbon footprint and so forth.
What's the cost to take part?
Right now, we have our membership at $50 a month, but we also have the ability for people who cannot afford that to reduce it, what we call our starving hacker rate. And that's pretty well up to the board to determine.
All right.
So there are benefits for the people who can't afford the $50 for whatever reason.
But can contribute.
But can still contribute.
Okay.
We're still learning a lot, too. It's a fairly new group, so...
Well, that would be exciting for someone contributing, too.
Sure. Because there's all kinds of different ways. No, I know. There's all kinds of different ways to contribute to the group. It's not just to produce things or to... so forth. It's also to contribute to the functioning of the group and enhancing the group itself. If you have an expertise in a certain area, there's probably a few people who are willing to learn something from you. We have a couple of talks that we have each month hosted by various members. One is called right now Secure Your Stuff, and basically it's the whole philosophy of securing things that are valuable to you. And it's not just, okay, this is a recipe of how I secure my computer. It's very much, okay, what is valuable? Why is it valuable? What would you think about doing? You know, how valuable is it? How quickly do you need to get at it? Much more than this is you follow these steps and we'll have it secure.
You say this is like a series of talks?
Yes.
Really? When does it start? Or has it already started?
They've already started. We have another group, a math group, that just discusses math concepts and so. But to a large extent, the groups end up being things that reflect the audience.
All right.
So if you have an interest in a particular area, the group tends to veer in that direction, or the discussion ends up veering in that direction as well. So, yes, it's an interesting time to participate. It's a very interesting group to be a part of. And I'm constantly fascinated by how many skills are available within the group and how much people are willing to learn and to pass on to other people as well.
And you said Tuesday nights is probably the best time to put your foot in the water.
Sure. We always have a short meeting starting around 7 o'clock, and we're always willing to give tours of the place. Among the things that we are also working on in the near future is building a dark room.
Okay.
We're also looking at a bit of a sound booth and sound studio. We have an IT area for our computer equipment. And we're doing all kinds of different projects just to keep people, as that really reflect the interests of the members of the group. So for new members, we quickly end up reflecting their interests as well.
And again, you said this was Niagara and Land, right? What was the
yes,
number?
Yes, 152 Niagara Street.
All right. Did you have anything more you wanted to say about this before we wrap our interview?
Come on out. We keep having interesting things. A few weeks ago, we had somebody bring in some robots to play with.
Wow.
And they're really interesting. So, yes, come on out.
And that was on a Tuesday, wasn't it?
It was on a Tuesday evening.
Yeah.
And so, yes, there's always something interesting going on. We're only going to get better.
All right.
And, yeah, be a part of the biggest hackerspace in Ontario and the best hackerspace here in Ontario with ThinkHouse.
Thanks, Richard. Thanks very much for coming in to explain that and lay it out before the listener.
You're welcome. Thanks very much.
Welcome to Disrespect's weekly review of the news. We remind you this is not the article that we read to you. These are excerpts from the articles out of the periodicals by the authors that we read to you on the air. Before our first item, I want to relate that we approached TVO for permission, copyright permission, to air a half-hour interview with Steve Paikin on the agenda about the TV tax. TVO informed us that they had made commitments that they couldn't deviate from, which forbid them from allowing them to share this interview with you. But it is on TVO. It is a podcast available from TVO's agenda. And if you are confused about the TV tax, both sides are represented, and we urge you to read it, to listen to it. The first article by Luann LaSalle. This is Canadian Press, but it's printed in The Spectator. CRTC asks citizens to go online, share views on TV tax. Montreal. Canadians are being asked about the so-called TV tax and the affordability of cable television and satellite services on a special website set up by the CRTC. At the heart of the debate is a battle between the major television broadcasters and cable and satellite companies over who pays for TV signals. The broadcasters have asked the CRTC to compel the cable and satellite operators to pay for the broadcasters' TV signals to help maintain local stations and programming. Cable companies have said such a fee could result in charging their customers as much as $10 a month on top of their bills to cover the extra costs. Telecom analyst Mark Goldberg said asking consumers if they want to pay more automatically brings in a negative response. So unless there's some real value being put forward, I don't think that you need to canvass 30 million Canadians to ask them if they want to pay more for anything, he said. In the end, consumers will be in the driver's seat, said Goldberg of Toronto area Mark Goldberg and Associates Incorporated, telecommunications consulting. We're going to choose to watch whatever content we want when we want to. One way or another, it's available in various formats. On September 17, 2008, less than 1% of $1.9 billion fund for social housing spent so far by Bill Curry in The Globe in Ottawa. On September 17, 2008, in an unusual use of government business during an election campaign, then Human Resources Minister Monty Solberg announced the $1.9 billion housing fund with then Environment Minister John Baird in Mr. Baird's Ottawa riding. The minister said it was a government announcement and not an election pledge. It was later confirmed in the February 2009 budget, along with three other new funds for social housing. But as of September 30, 2009, only 0.4% of the $1.9 billion announced for housing and homelessness programs for low-income Canadians had actually been spent. Only 4.6% of a $1 billion fund to renovate existing social housing units has been spent, while 1.9% of a $400 million fund for low-income seniors housing is out the door. Only 0.1% of a $75 million construction fund to house people with disabilities has been spent. The percentages of money actually spent are dramatically lower than the 80 to 90% figures cited in government-funded economic action plans that use the terms like already being implemented. If it was a report card for grade school, it would be a dismal failing grade, said Liberal MP Michelle Simpson, who requested the data. The rookie MP said she was shocked to see the state of social housing apartments in her Scarborough Southwest riding when she went door knocking during the last campaign. Just horrible living conditions, bugs, cockroaches, that kind of thing. And they're waiting 9 years to get into a place like that that I wanted to be out of in 9 seconds and felt sick about. Federal provincial housing ministers are scheduled to meet with Federal Minister Diane Finley in Gatineau this week to discuss the flow of housing cash. There's not been a traditional gathering of housing ministers since 2005, before the Harper government came to office. Spectator, Thursday, December 3rd, 2009. Church group loses CETA grants in wake of criticisms. Toronto, a Canadian church-based group that does human rights and environmental sustainability work, says the federal government has cancelled its funding for overseas project without warning or reason. Supporters of Kairos say the ecumenical social justice group is being punished for being critical of the oil sands and the Harper government's climate change policy. A Kairos delegation was to travel to the United Nations Climate Change Conference in Copenhagen to help lobby for an agreement that would include substantial cuts to greenhouse gas emissions. Last May, a Kairos delegation toured Alberta's oil sands region to see how massive projects are affecting Aboriginal people and determine if the operations are environmentally sustainable. The delegation included leaders from the Anglican, Christian Reformed, Evangelical Lutheran, Presbyterian, and United Churches, as well as representatives from the Canadian Conference of Catholic Bishops. At the time, the leaders said they planned to share their impressions with their congregations and reach a consensus that would be presented to the federal government as early as fall. Said Mary Corkery, the executive director of Kairos, "Why did you cut us? That's the question. We need them to put it on the table." Maud Barlow of the Council of Canadians said Kairos has a long history of promoting human rights and sustainable environmental policies in developing countries. It's also worked hard to educate Canadians. Officials at CIDA, CETA, and the Minister of International Cooperation's office did not return calls asking for comment. And this from the Globe and Mail, Thursday, November 12th. Keith Leslie in Toronto. A panel set up by the Ontario government to review healthcare services in rural and northern communities is nonsense because it won't stop hospitals from cutting services or closing altogether, complain activists, local politicians, and doctors. The Ontario Health Coalition, a coalition of community groups, said the panel won't even ask the public about ways to provide better services as many hospitals struggle with growing budget deficits. Everybody understood that the panel would be an independent third-party look at the policy direction of the government with regard to the closures of small and rural hospitals, and we're shocked to see a mandate that doesn't include that at all, said spokeswoman Natalie Mira. So it's nonsense. Ontario's 14 local health integration networks, or LHINs, will still be able to close emergency rooms or even entire hospitals before the panel reports next year, said Mrs. Mira. This process provides no direction for those communities as to whether or not these hospitals can be closed now in order to meet the short-term budget imperatives, or whether the government is going to develop policies to explicitly protect them. Don McGugan, the mayor of Brook Alvinston near Sarnia, said the government's panel needs to speak to the people that will be affected by the health service cuts. The province created the LHINs to provide political cover for unpopular decisions to reduce local health care services, said Mr. McGugan. The LHINs are set up to protect the minister, he said. And from The Spectator, by Maureen Leyland, Norma Ducow, and Linda Hall, on behalf of the Hamilton branch of the Canadian Federation of University Women. Clawbacks wound Ontario's poorest. People are still living in dire poverty and children go to school hungry. Deceptive and discriminatory are two words to describe the Ontario government's restructuring in July of the social assistance program. These words are unavoidable when we see the lower amounts of money some families are now receiving on the Ontario Works and the Ontario Disability Support Program. A central piece of the government's plan to reduce poverty in Ontario includes an initiative called the Ontario Child Benefit, OCB. It meant that all families with children would receive a benefit of $50 per month for each child. In July, the government announced with great acclaim the Ontario Child Benefit would be increased to $92. We know the Ontario Child Benefit includes the former back-to-school allowance and the winter clothing allowance, two lump sums mailed out in August and September. Unfortunately, they have been included in the child benefit, and that same money accounts for some of the increase. The most revealing example of the punitive impact of this restructuring is a single mother on the Ontario Disability Support Program with a 14-year-old daughter. In early August of this year, she received a check for the Ontario Child Benefit showing an increase of approximately $420. However, at the end of the same month, she discovered that the basic needs portion of her support had been reduced by almost the same amount as the child benefit had been increased. Her net gain was $1, a clear case of a clawback. This clawbacking of already inadequate income is particularly upsetting given the announcement by the Ontario government that the increase would benefit all children. In fact, the increase is distributed in a very discriminatory way. Low-income families who do not receive social assistance receive the full amount of $92. Yes, deceptive, discriminatory, and clawback are the most appropriate words to describe the government's restructuring of social assistance. The Hamilton branch of the Canadian Federation of University Women earnestly calls on the Ontario government to stop the clawbacks, restore the basic needs allowance to its former levels without clawback, and provide a $100 per month healthy food supplement for all adults without clawback. To quote Nelson Mandela, overcoming poverty is not a gesture of charity. It is an act of justice. It is the protection of a fundamental right, the right to dignity and a decent life. Spectator, Saturday, December 5th. Stories by Carmela Fragamini. Does $572 a month cover basic needs? Could you live on $572 a month? Anti-poverty activists want you to do the math. Can you pay the rent, your bills, and buy decent food for yourself with that? Not likely, they say. They've already had 3,000 people visit the dothemath.thestop.org website and do the interactive budgeting exercise to see if they could live on welfare or on disability assistance. A single person on Ontario Works gets $572 a month, and someone on an Ontario Disability Support Program benefit gets $1,020. The Do the Math website was launched to raise awareness and show how social assistance does not meet the basic food, rent, and other needs of recipients. A survey of the 3,000 people spending a half hour to find out what it would take to live healthily on social assistance shows the average amount the participants said a person would need to live on was $1,490, about 2.5 times what people get on Ontario Works. Dr. Chris Mackey, an associate medical officer of health, told the meeting that poverty is one of the most important health issues Hamilton faces. Peter Clutterbuck of Social Planning Network of Ontario said poverty groups will continue to try to meet with MPPs and press them to do the math. One anti-poverty group, the Interfaith Social Assistance Reform Coalition, will also conduct social audits across the province to build more public and community support for the $100 healthy food supplement, he said. He said the anti-poverty groups also want to meet with Community and Social Services Minister Madeleine Meilleur to urge her to present the $100 healthy food supplement proposal to Cabinet. MPP Sophia Aglinaitis did the math exercise at the urging of the 25 and 5 Hamilton Network for Poverty Reduction this past summer. Now she says it's an exercise all politicians should do. It's really important we see this with our own eyes. Now, I don't know how many statistics you can absorb in one sitting, but the Thursday, December 3rd, Hamilton Spectator, on the inside of the front page, Mark McNeil has laid out the stats for food banks under the title Feeding the Need. More than 5,000 local parents struggle to feed their children each month and regularly sacrifice their own food so their children can eat. 1 in 10 parents report that their children go hungry at least 2 days a week. 42% of food bank users are children under 18. Food bank use has increased 26% across the board, 33% by children, 22% by adults, 22% in families relying on food banks to meet basic food needs. Christmas hampers last year, 10,347 Christmas hampers were given out, 25,548 people were assisted. Food bank user profile, 27% are single parents. 20% of total are dual parent families, 44% are single, 9% were couples with no children. Food bank income profile, 12.2% are working, 6.2% are looking for work, 45.8% are on welfare, 21.6% are on disability benefits, 5% have no income, 5.4% are over 65 years old, 2.9% had various forms of income. Food bank volunteers. 6,982 volunteers gave 72,362 hours to food banks and hot meal programs last year. That's the equivalent of 40 full-time positions. Did you know? Food banks allow only one visit per month, give out only 3 days' worth of food, close in December to redirect resources to filling Christmas hampers. Food bank use increase, measured each year in March. 15,511 in March 2008, 19,602 in March 2009. Households, 6,324 in March 2008, 7,685 in March 2009. Hamilton Food Share's Holiday Food Drive will be accepting money and non-perishable nutritious food dropped off at locations around the city. For a list, see thespec.com. Now, you know I love the sound of my own voice, but even I need a break from it. This is Big Joe Duskin, Cuban Sugar Mill. Thank you. Again, The Spectator, Friday, December 4th, from the Toronto Star, Natives March Against HST. First Nations protesters angry over the proposed harmonized sales tax move through Toronto's core, stopping to shut down intersections as they loop down from Queen's Park and back again on Thursday the 3rd. Native bands from across the province came to Toronto to protest the tax that was approved by the House of Commons for Ontario and British Columbia earlier in the day. "We have an inherent right not to pay it," said Toronto's Kevin Kopgog of the Beausoleil First Nation, waving a red Mohawk flag. "We're allies of the Queen, not subjects." The gathering began at Queen's Park at 2 p.m. Then the ululating Wingush singers and traditional drummers led the group south down University Avenue. For almost 3 hours, the estimated 300 protesters made their way through the core. "Aboriginals should be a rich people," said Leah Rogers, 29, of Kettle Point First Nation. She made the four-hour drive from a reserve at the south end of Lake Huron to attend the protest. "This is all our land." Currently, Ontario Natives do not pay the PST. To be exempt from the GST status, Indians must get purchased goods delivered to the reserve by the vendor. Seniors rip Ontario over no mercy HST. Canadian Press. Toronto. Seniors will be among the hardest hit by a 13% single sales tax in Ontario and won't forget that fact in the next election, opponents of the harmonized sales tax told a legislative committee yesterday. Ontario will merge its 8% sales tax with the 5% GST on July the 1st, raising the price on items currently exempt from the PST, including gasoline, home heating fuel, and services such as dry cleaning, haircuts, and funerals. "Even in death, the harmonized sales tax shows no mercy," Paul Bailey, president of the Police Pensioners Association of Ontario, told the committee in the first of 2 days of public hearings. "Seniors will die and their families, those on fixed incomes and limited support, will be forced to pay an additional cost to bury their loved ones. Our question to government is, why are you targeting seniors?" Bailey warned the Liberals they would face the wrath of the province's elderly in the 2011 election if the HST is implemented. And by Adam Radwanski in the Globe and Mail last Monday. Dalton McGuinty's Ontario Liberals have always maintained that their new harmonized sales tax will help rather than hinder their re-election prospects in 2011. Even now, with polls showing overwhelming opposition to the HST and at least one giving the opposition Conservatives a double-digit lead, senior liberals insist it's going according to plan. "It's a matter of weathering the storm," they say, "until after it's been implemented next summer." They may yet prove correct, and if not, it will be because at least five key assumptions proved fatal. First, taxes are taxes. Taxpayers are less likely to notice relatively marginal savings on their paychecks than increased levies on consumer goods. That's especially so if a new tax is applied to items they purchase with great frequency, which is why the government announced an exemption on coffee and fast food. It will still be newly applied on gasoline, haircuts, taxi rides, and other purchases that will remind Ontarians of its existence. The Liberals are trying to blunt the HST's impact by mailing checks to taxpayers in its first year, but it remains to be seen whether this will be perceived as helpful or cynical. The more substantive argument is that savings to businesses will eventually be passed down to consumers. But by then, a different party could be in office. Second, a conflicted opposition equals a weaker opposition. The federal Conservatives, notably Jim Flaherty, husband of erstwhile leadership candidate and current deputy leader Christine Elliott, were the driving force behind the reform, and many provincial Tories had made supportive noises previously, with even new leader Tim Hudak having expressed openness. But contradictions be damned, the Tories have attacked the HST with gusto. This may get trickier as an election draws closer if voters are bothered that they won't repeal it and didn't lobby Ottawa to stop it. But for now, there's little equivocation in their attacks. Third, it helps to have friends in high places. The Liberals assumed that during a recession, the public would place a premium on economic foresight. So by the time they announced the HST last March, they'd lined up economists and business leaders to sing its praises, a strategy that continued this fall when the University of Calgary's Jack Mintz enthused that their tax reform package would create nearly 600,000 jobs. There's little evidence thus far of this strategy working, and the Conservatives, believing it can be used against the government, are aiming to paint the Liberals as out-of-touch elitists. For every economist, the Tories and the NDP are trotting out an aggrieved small business owner, condo dweller, or pensioner, and so far they seem to be winning the argument. Fourth, the more the merrier. Early on, the Liberals thought they might be at the forefront of a national consensus that would insulate them from criticism. But an incredibly ham-handed rollout in BC prompted a backlash in that province beyond anything in Ontario and helped create the impression the HST is something sinister. Manitoba stepped back from implementing it while the governing NDP went through a leadership contest and hasn't leaped at the opportunity since. And if the Liberals were expecting help from Ottawa, they haven't got it. As a result, Mr. McGuinty's Liberals have found selling it a lonely undertaking. And finally, and fifth, boldness is its own reward. This is the biggest assumption and the most untested. The political calculus of the HST is that voters will appreciate Mr. McGuinty risked his future on a policy he knew would be difficult to sell, but believed was economically essential. That gamble is predicated on the idea that he amassed enough political capital to pull it off. His doubters, who've always viewed him as an accidental premier, benefiting until recently from inept opposition, beg to differ. Mr. McGuinty, who embraced the HST over the objections of some high-profile Liberals, had cause to redouble his efforts to sell it. He'll be looking to prove he did not overestimate his own appeal. From the Spectator, call 911, heart attack victim told at hospital. This from the Canadian Press. Halifax, an elderly woman with a cane and a heart condition was told to bring her husband into a Nova Scotia hospital on her own or call 911 after he suffered a heart attack 10 meters from the facility's front door, the couple's son said yesterday. Patrick Smale said his 81-year-old father began having chest pains last weekend and drove to the Soldiers Memorial Hospital in Middleton, about 2 hours outside Halifax. Smale said his mother, who doesn't drive and has had two heart valve replacements, went inside the hospital to get help because her husband was unable to walk on his own because of the pain. She was told by hospital staff that they couldn't come out and she should bring him in herself or call 911, Smale said. I couldn't believe it. I just assumed that if someone's having a suspected heart attack at the front entrance, at least a nurse or security guard would get a wheelchair to get him in the door, he said in Halifax, where his father was receiving treatment. It just seemed ridiculous that they had to call 911 to get an ambulance to do it. Smale said the outcome could have been different if an ambulance wasn't at its post when the call went out for his dad, who had a triple bypass about 3 years ago and suffers from angina. Smale said his father was expected to recover, but hopes staff will change their practices. And briefly, in the good news department, with light sentence for arsonist, judge defies mantra of jail. Stiff penalties harm society, he says. Kirk Macon, justice reporter for the Globe and Mail. Defying community anger and Canada's drift towards more punitive U.S.-style sentencing laws, an Ontario judge has given two Aboriginal youths a lenient punishment for burning down a venerable community building. Justice John Keast of Superior Court in Sudbury said that probation and a strong dose of rehabilitation is better than throwing the boys, aged 12 and 13, into secure custody. The Sudbury case involved two youths who used a can of gasoline to torch the 61-year-old Steelworkers Hall, hallowed hub of community life, in September 2008. It took 26 hours for firefighters to extinguish the $8 million blaze. Judge Keast determined that locking up the arsonists would satisfy a certain primal desire for punishment, but create a pair of hardened criminals. Judge Keith said that Canada would do well to emulate Scandinavian countries, which pour money into social programs rather than responding with the mantra of jail. He said that most criminals are shaped by poverty and lack of opportunity. Most of today's serious criminals were once victims. And again from The Spectator, this from The Associated Press, Ford rebuffed woman keeps $82.6 million. The U.S. Supreme Court has left in place an $82.6 million award to a woman paralyzed after her Ford Explorer rolled over. The justices yesterday rejected Ford Motor Company's challenge to the portion of the award, $55 million, intended as punitive damages. Ford argued it should not be punished because its design of the vehicle met federal safety standards. A California state appeals court earlier rejected Ford's contention and upheld the award to Benetta Buell Wilson. She was driving on an interstate east of San Diego in January 2002 when she swerved to avoid a metal object and lost control of her 1997 Explorer, which rolled four times. The mother of two was paralyzed from the waist down when the roof collapsed on her. We conclude our broadcast until January 14th with a wish for a happy season and a little gospel by Katie Webster. Hallelujah, I just love him so.
Coffee in my favorite cup, that's why I know, yes I know, hallelujah, I just love him so. When I'm in trouble and I need a friend, you know he'll go with me to the end. Everybody asks me how I know, I smile at them and say he told me so, that's why I know. Call him on the telephone. Say, baby, I'm all alone. By the time I come from 1 to 4, I hear him knocking on my door. In the evening when the sun goes down and there is nobody else around, everybody asks me how I know. I smile at them and say, he told me so, that's why I know. Yes, I know. Hallelujah, I just love him so. Telephone. Say, baby, I'm all alone. By the time I come from 1 to 4, I hear him knocking on my door. In the evening when the sun goes down and there is nobody else around, everybody asks me how I know. I smile at them and say, he told me so, that's why I know. Yes, I know. Hallelujah, I just love him so. Well, hallelujah, I just love him so. Hallelujah, I just love him so. Well, hallelujah, I just love my baby so.
Zat-do-do, hey. Oh, yeah.
If you can't access a Disrespect broadcast, you can now listen to the show wherever you're near an internet download. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number 4, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.